Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on KHOI Community Radio. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We talk about lots of good things to eat. Today we are going to talk about cooking with fire with special guest Scott Coldiron from Vesuvius Pizza. But first, today we'll explore some things that Donna has noticed at local farm stands. What's available to eat?
Oh, boy, oh, boy. We're finally getting some summer food. The Grimes Corn Stand is up on the corner of 13th and, where is it? Grand? 13th and Grand, right. So we got our peaches and cream corn. I had my first batch yesterday. It's small, of course, but it is very flavorful this year. The ears seem fully formed, and I pushed it. I shucked it and threw it right into a stock pot of chicken stock and cooked it briefly, and it was divine.
The first corn of the season. I've never had corn in chicken stock before. What a good idea.
Well, it was an accident. The pans were all full, and there was this big pot of liquid boiling, and I thought, yeah, that should work. And it really was. I think I might do it again. So the corn was great. The musk melons are here, and she corrected me at the stand. They are not cantaloupe. They are musk melons.
It seems to be a fine distinction. But did you find out what a musk melon and a cantaloupe is?
Looked it up, and apparently all cantaloupes are musk melons. However, not all musk melons happen to be cantaloupes. So in Iowa, we grew up calling them musk melons, so... Anyway, whatever they are, I'm going to try and get myself one today. She had sold out already by the time I got there. I'm just happy that we're finally into melon season. And Lana has some peaches news.
Oh, peaches news. For those of you who have ventured up north of Ames to Story City, there's a market stand up there. For the past couple of years, it's been called Nan's Market Stand. But guess what? I found out. This is farm stand gossip. Slim is back. For many, many years, it's been Slim's roadside market up there. Slim is back, and this man knows how to pick peaches. Wherever he sources his peaches from, I always have a good luck with them. He had big lugs of peaches up there. Missouri peaches are in, and Slim is back.
I'm so glad. I'm going to go up this afternoon and get myself some Missouri peaches.
Had some last night.
How were they?
Pretty dandy. Actually, they could have ripened a little bit more, but I couldn't wait. So buy some, and by tomorrow, they're going to be really, really nice.
Perfect. And then the tomato report, Lana?
Oh, tomato report. Mine are just hanging on the vine, being green, green, green. The blight is sort of taking over my life, so it's depressing, but the tomatoes are still setting, so we shall see. I have been enjoying many of the smaller tomatoes. I've got some salad-sized tomatoes, kind of ping-pong ball size, on down to cherry tomatoes. So those are wonderful, and I'm eating my fair share of those, but still waiting for the big ones, at least from our place.
And this ridiculously chill July weather is probably not helping.
Well, no, it's not. Here I sit. It's the middle of July, and I wore a sweater this morning. So there you have it. Also, I want to mention that for those of you who have garlic harvest has happened already or is happening. I'm waiting until this weekend to harvest my garlic because, again, like everything else, it's late, it's small. But it's there. So garlic harvest on my farm will happen. And if you have garlic in your garden, look to see if it is getting ready. Different varieties take different amounts of time. I judge garlic readiness by counting how many leaves on the bottom are dried up. They start drying up from the bottom. And last week there were two leaves. I wait till there's at least four leaves dried and ready to go. And it looks like this weekend for me will be about the time. Although I've talked to other folks, including the folks at Mustard Seed Farm, that harvested last week. And garlic is good. That's fine.
So next week we'll probably have to talk a little bit about how to use fresh garlic, how to cure garlic. So come back for that. Now we have a special guest today in the studio. He's a man who plays with fire. Scott Coldiron. I like to say that Scott is actually one of the best professional chefs we have in Ames. And even though you would, you know, you'll know it when you taste his pizza because there's some really special qualities to it. He also has the only wood-fired oven in town. Even though there are people with, quote, brick ovens, they're usually gas-fired. And Scott's is the only wood-fired oven in town. And so he's going to tell you a little bit about – first, Scott, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
And tell us where Vesuvius is.
Vesuvius is located at 1620 South Kellogg here in Ames, right off of South Duff.
It's really near the freeway.
Right, yeah, right just on the northwest corner of Highway 30 and South Duff.
And you kind of have to go around to the backside to get in. What street is that you turn on to go around to the?
It's South 16th.
You go down 16th.
Right, and then that's Kellogg there that picks it up, and then you just work your way back to the parking lot.
Right, it's next to the Mongolian blah, blah.
The Buffet Mongolian.
Yes, there you go. So, Scott, tell us a little bit about how Vesuvius got started and how you ended up in Ames and that sort of the backstory.
Sure. Well, we opened Vesuvius in January of 2010. And prior to that, I had been the executive chef of a private golf club in the Twin Cities area. My wife and I lived in, we had a house in St. Paul and both had decent jobs there and were progressing in our careers. And then we decided that we hadn't had enough challenges in our life, and so decided to open a business of our own.
Oh, boy, oh, boy.
Well, I got to the point in my career where I thought, you know, I'd been cooking for, you know, I'd been in professional kitchens at that point for around 20 years, and I thought I was ready to try something of my own. And so we thought about what we wanted to do and had seen a few concepts that we really liked and things that I thought, for me, from a culinary perspective, made sense and were appealing, and then also from a business sense and an operational sense were advantageous for us. And you know,
why Ames?
Well, that's a good question. I am not from Iowa, but my wife is. She was born and raised in a small town called Dowse,
just a little bit up 35 from here.
45, 50 minutes north of here, right off of Interstate 35. And so part of our long-term plan, which is kind of how we've always arranged our affairs, is we look at, we have kind of medium and long-range plans in our life. And so part of those plans were to start a business, like I said, and then also to work our way back. She had grown up. We wanted to live out in the country. We were kind of done of living in cities.
So you went to actually raise the kids where she grew up.
Yeah, and be closer to her family. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of put those things together and came up with and decided, looking at the markets that were around, you know, where it made sense for us to have our business. Mm-hmm. And so we decided on Ames.
Well, I first kind of heard that Scott was coming to town because he was making inquiries through PFI about how to buy local produce and stuff like that. And I thought, that is a good way to go.
Right. So, and you were probably the first person I talked to in Ames about where to get some local stuff. One of the very first people. I remember having a conversation with you when I was sitting in the parking lot at the club when I was going into work one day when we were trying to get this whole thing going. So,
it was a chef's conversation.
You knew about it before anybody else.
That's right.
Pretty
and I
much.
Thought, this young fellow is worth encouraging. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was great. You were a big help then, and you still are now. So that's awesome.
Well, I must say, I love the pizza. It's Neapolitan style. So it's thin crust.
It's a Neapolitan style wood-fired pizza. And what that means, I mean, when you say Neapolitan, it's got a few specific connotations. The first thing is that it's cooked in a very high heat wood-fired oven. The second thing is that the dough is both produced and handled in a specific way. You know, when you stretch it, you stretch it out into a very thin through the center crust with kind of a light, airy outer crust. And then It also means that you would be using a certain style of tomato sauce and a certain style of cheese, a mozzarella cheese, mm-hmm. a fresh mozzarella, mm-hmm. as opposed to the low moisture sort of aged, whatever, shredded version that you would find it's ubiquitous, everywhere mm-hmm. else. But, and so all those things taken together produce a pretty unique style of pizza. It's also happens to be, a more traditional style of pizza, one that's mm-hmm. been around for a very long time. And it's an elemental thing. The cooking appliance, the oven itself is very elemental. You're only working with a wood fire and a stone floor and dome, basically.
And you have, in the restaurant, there is no other oven. It's only...
No, that's the...
That's it.
As I have a very small burner in the back that we use for a couple of very specific things, but everything else is done in the oven. We mm-hmm. roast our garlic. We roast all of our vegetables in there, artichokes, mushrooms. We do our oven-dried tomatoes with that oven.
Cool.
It's the only cooking appliance in the entire place. So...
Tell me, how do you start the fire every day, and how do you get it to the right temperature? Where do you buy the wood? What's the process?
Yeah, well, it's after being in business for 5 years now, we've got a pretty good routine. When we first started out, we were only open 6 days. We closed one day of the week. We're now open 7 days. And so being a seven-day operation, really, we get there at 10 a.m. We open for business at 11 a.m. The oven is so good at what it does in holding the heat and being efficient in that way that we basically only have to come in, take the door out from the oven. The oven has a little arch, and we have a little steel door that's
and,
we
and
set
in
there.
And when you come into the restaurant, the oven's highly visible. You can see the whole process.
Yeah. And we actually designed the space so that when you hit the front door, you're staring right
it's
into the opening of the oven.
It's fun for children to see
too. They
I
love
think
it.
It's really great.
Yeah, everybody's fascinated by it, and people will come and stand and watch us. They're fascinated by us rolling out it's an exhibition kitchen, so everything's
absolutely.
Done right out there. So you get to see us toss the dough out, top the pizzas, and cook. Everything's done right in front of you. People love watching that. So when we come in, the oven is still so hot from the previous night, and we have a bed of coals. So basically, when we close at night, we take all the hot coals, pile them all into the center of the oven.
So you just kind of bank it down for the night.
Yeah, and put the door in. That keeps some of the heat in from escaping out the door. Heat still goes out the flue, but it's exhausting through the flue. But, the floor and the dome, the material that they are made out of is so good and efficient at holding heat.
Is it some kind of ceramic?
Yeah, it's a specific kind of refractory ceramic material that is cast.
Is this Italian oven?
This is an Italian-made oven by Valoriani. There's a handful of companies in Italy that make these ovens and then import them to the U.S. and elsewhere, but that have been making these and building these ovens for 100 years or more.
Cool.
And, what's unique about each of the different companies, they'll, have claim to one sort of specific kind of ceramic material or the other that, is superior than the other. But in any case, the material is designed to hold the heat, and it does that very well. And so we just... When we come in the morning, we have a large pile of live coals. We
you could be like slow roasting something all night if you wanted
sure.
to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if you wanted to. Yeah, and that's something if I were
I'm gonna
to
bring a few chickens by one evening and come back and
beef
get them
brisket.
In the morning. Yeah.
Absolutely, it would work. and so then, and honestly, it's about 30-35 minutes, from the time I start the fire again in the morning. I've got live coals. I put on some firewood, and off we go.
That's fantastic. And
if I absolutely needed to, I could have it ready to go in 20 minutes. So, it's about 550 degrees still when we come in. And so,
well, I bet you don't have a heating bill in the winter.
Well, that's just it. We do because all the heat stays in the oven. It doesn't radiate out,
Which is exactly how you want it.
So yeah, exactly.
So, as I understand, the fire is in the middle of the oven, and then you kind of have to kick it out of the way to put food in?
Well, what we do, we leave the fire in the middle to get it fired before opening. And then once we're ready to open, then we'll scoot everything off to the side.
Fire off to the side.
Yeah, exactly. Scoot the coals and add a little more fuel and, get the deck cleaned up. And then we're ready. So then And it's a fairly large oven. It's actually bigger than what we need. Yeah, so then we build the fire off to the side, and then we can line pizzas around, you know, so that if you were to look at right in the opening of the oven, you would see us with a ring of pizzas, you know, four and five pizzas around the,
so you
and
can
a semicircle
put in
four
or five
fire
at a time?
Yeah, there's space for more. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could do.
So what's the diameter of the inside of the cooking floor?
This oven is a little unusual. It's the largest in the line that Valoriani makes. It's 140 centimeters by 160, so it's actually a slight oval, not a circle.
Okay, so sort of in inches, roughly, that's...
What is 147? Like 70 inches?
Oh, okay, 70 inches diameter, kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, around there.
Yeah, that's
But again, that's far
size.
Larger than what I need mm-hmm. is what I've discovered.
You could make it into a crematorium. Oops, excuse me.
But so, you know, I... When we... The question of the number of pizzas is really a non-starter anymore because doing three and four pizzas at a time with the cook time that I have now and the oven management that we're able to use now, I can keep up on the busiest service night, Friday or Saturday night, doing three and four at a time rather than having to get seven or eight in there at a time.
Because we're talking fast. This yeah. man does fast pizzas.
Right. 90 seconds or less. Between 60 and 90
Amazing.
Seconds.
And we're talking... And you can be so fast because it's so hot. What kind of temperatures do you deal with?
Well, the ambient temperature is probably around 900 degrees. It varies a little bit, you know, because as the fire builds and burns down, the temperature is constantly shifting. It's either, you know.
Can you do that by feel? It's visual or you can feel it?
It's at this point, it's all feel and experience and just as you are watching the pizzas cook. I mean, you're taking in all that sensory data and mm-hmm. and now, you know, after a couple of years now, all the staff that I have that works the oven, that's the last job anybody learns mm-hmm. is the oven because it's the most challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But the people I have working for me now have been with me a minimum of 2 years. And so and we've done thousands and thousands of pizzas at this point. So it's all a feel thing. They know by looking at the fire, looking at the pizzas, you know, just where it is in the cycle of heating and cooling. You're always trying to, because you have the floor and the dome of the oven, you're always trying to regulate the temperatures of both and get them in the right sort of harmony between a deck that is hot enough. If your deck's too cool and your dome's – if your deck's too cool, the bottoms won't cook and the face of the pizza will be done before the bottom is. If the – and vice versa. If the deck is too hot, then the face of the pizza will not be ready before you're burning the bottom. And again, we're talking –
it's quite a dance, isn't
90
it?
Seconds or less, so
yeah.
you don't have a lot of time to sort it out, you know. So
what do you think this experience of 4 years of cooking every day with wood and real heat and the whole nature of it, what do you think it's done to your brain?
Well, I don't cook many pizzas anymore. I would much rather be on another spot on the – I still work the line every day. I'll cook all the pizzas I need to cook. But, no, you know, it's funny because the reason I – wanted to open a restaurant that had this sort of food, this sort of
very elemental
cuisine.
Yeah,
is that my experience? My culinary philosophy was leading me in that direction mm-hmm. in the 10 years prior to that. Because at a private club, there's a lot of great things about that sort of environment. There's some disadvantages to it as well, but one of the great things about working in a private club like that, you know, and you know, as a chef with the private clubs and the hotels, you get a very wide variety of experience. You get to try a lot mm-hmm. of different kinds of cooking, and a private club, even more so than a hotel, you're exposed to a lot of different things, and you're also, because I was also in charge, I was able to basically go in any direction I wanted to go in with my cooking. And there was countless events for the members and opportunities throughout the calendar year, and the food that we cooked that I could come up with anything I wanted to do. Like one year, we'd have a big invitational golf tournament, and I would. One year, I decided we were going to pit roast suckling pigs,
uh-huh.
but do it in the ground. So I had the groundskeeper come out, dig in a enormous hole. I built a fire for 2 days, had the coals, wrapped up the pigs, put them in the ground, buried them, came back day later.
So that started you with fire.
Yeah, exactly. There's that. And I got into...
Can you squeeze a pig into your oven now?
I could. Probably.
I'm thinking Christmas could. Dinner
Yes,
here.
I could. We'd have to shut it down for 3 days, though, to go slow enough. But
we use small pigs.
Yeah. But, you know, so I was doing things like... I was also getting very much into... preserving foods. Mm. So like prosciutto is a great, you know, is a great example.
And you use LaQuercia on your pizzas,
we
right?
We do, right. And, you know.
Nothing
and,
but the best
And so
Vesuvius.
Like smoked meats, you know, there's all preserved foods, you know, are very basic, but then there's this technique that's really informed that's behind it. And it's both that of, it used to be as a matter of necessity, but now it's just this technique that exists because it was handed down, but it produces these amazing results, too. So my culinary, you know, philosophy was leading me in that direction, and so I had already been experimenting a lot with working with fire, doing smoked meats, preserved things.
Are you smoking anything now?
Only at home. Only when I cook at home, I'm cooking with fire again. That's what I do at home. I'm outside. I'm starting up the grill. So
So do you have a smoker at home?
I do. I do some smoked stuff at home.
Oh, folks,
and
I can feel this is a whole separate show. We're going to have
yeah,
Scott back
absolutely.
Talking about home smoking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably in the
I'm not great at it, but I'm okay at it, and I've gotten better as the years have gone by. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some guy. I mean, there's just exclusively barbecue guys that's all they do, mm-hmm, and they're very, very good at it. You know, I'm not one of those guys, but you know, well, I'm a cook, so I can fake it.
Yeah, well, and like most cooks, we get you're always exploring new territory,
right?
So that never a dull moment.
Exactly.
I know Lana and Joe have their own wood-fired pizza oven out at their house, and
there's been a real interest in backyard pizza ovens. The internet is rife with good advice,
absolutely,
bad advice.
Sure.
And
do you have one at home too?
I do not.
Oh, yeah. But Lana does.
But we put one together, and we again, it's a hot process. My oven will not get up to 900 degrees. Mm. I cheat. We put a oven thermometer kind of into it with the sensor sticking down into the oven,
mm-hmm,
and so we can sort of tell if I can get mine up to maybe 500. I like to cook at like 450, and because it's a much smaller oven, but I'm not doing 100 pizzas.
Okay, smaller. What yours is maybe 24 inches across, do you think? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think our floor is about like that.
30 max.
I do one pizza at a time, but again, fire it inside.
Is the sensor in the – is it built into the deck of the oven? Was it done when you built the oven?
Yes, we just stuck it right into the clay top because we made the clay top.
Okay.
And so it goes all the way through.
Yeah, because a lot of the commercial ovens will have a sensor built into the deck of the, mm-hmm, oven. But if it's in that material, too, you got to take into account,
right,
so that, you know, so say the deck is 550 or 600 degrees, that's not going to give you the surface temp of the deck or the dome temp,
right,
or the ambient,
right,
temp.
Right.
So, and the deck temp will always be lower, you know, especially, mm-hmm, if you're an inch down, you know. So if your deck registers at about 550, then your ambient temperature might be 7 or 750.
Oh,
so,
for goodness sake.
So
yeah.
You're hotter than you
I'm
think?
I'm hotter.
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
Because when we do try to do a bunch of pizzas at a time, making an event, because it's quite a process to build enough firewood in a cold oven. It takes about 3-4 hours for us to get our oven hot. But then we have people over and make pizzas, and it's fine. But yes, the first few pizzas are about the minute, sort of 90 second, or they go fast. And then,
sure,
and then the oven is slowly cooling down. It takes a little bit longer, but that's okay. Everybody's had a piece, and we're on the second
right.
round. And we've really enjoyed it. And I know there's other people that have backyard pizza experiences,
oh,
too.
And Scott Vesuvius has a party option. Tell us about your portable.
Yeah, when you asked me a minute ago if I had one at home, I should have revised my answer that I do, but we use it for the restaurant, and I have a wood-fired oven on a trailer that we take around and do private catering events and do the odd festival or event here and there. And we've been out. We actually were in Des Moines a few weeks ago to do Wine Fest, and so a lot of different people got to try our pizza there. And
so you mean like if I wanted to have a big 70th birthday for myself in a few years or something, you could wheel it right into my back patio.
That's right.
We could have a
backyard. We pull the trailer up, you know, get a fire going and have pizzas rolling out of there in no time.
How fun. How fun.
Great. We're going to take a little break here and remind you that you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. Just taking a little music break. We'll come back to you. Back to Donna Lana Kitchen, talking to special guest Scott Coldiron about cooking with fire.
Scott is from Vesuvius
Pizza.
Vesuvius wood-fired pizza.
Right.
Right. And what's the address, Scott?
1620 South Kellogg.
There you go. So we were talking about building the fire.
Where do you get your firewood?
We get our firewood from a service in town, or they actually are just slightly outside of town. But the service that we buy from is called Finco, and they provide firewood to both other restaurants and residential, I believe, too.
Yeah, I buy my firewood for my wood stove from them, too.
Yeah, and the thing about they do a great job, and we've worked with them since we opened, we take a particular – we take only red oak. Any hardwood would work, but oak in particular has the right kind of characteristics of the hardwoods for a wood-fired oven.
And why red oak?
Well, oak in general would be okay. Red oak's more of a native species, so you're trying to stay a little bit closer. But also oak of the hardwoods, it burns. It burns very hot. It burns clean. It produces less smoke than some of the other hardwoods. There's less flavor transfer from that smoke, even though at 90 seconds there's not a whole lot of flavor transfer going on anyway.
Flavor transfer.
Yeah.
Got that one?
Right,
flavor transfer.
It's when flavors are bouncing off of foods they're not supposed to.
Yeah, sometimes you get flavor transfer in the refrigerator.
Exactly.
You know, when your ice cream tastes like garlic.
Yeah,
you know?
Your chocolate cake tastes like cream cheese, whatever. So the size of the firewood, we have it split a certain way, and it's got to be cured properly. You know, it's a beautiful thing to cook in these ovens when all the conditions are right, and you kind of need to have the conditions all just right. If you try working with dough, that is not ready. If you try working with firewood, that is not cured properly or not split the right size, the difficulty factor ramps up extremely quickly. So it looks simple from the outside, but, you know, there's a thousand little things that we're doing along the way that that aren't so easy.
And so what do you do with the wood ash?
We we only have a little bit that is produced. We just collect in a can and then we dispose of it once a week, really. Because the oven burns at such a high temperature that, it's so fully combusted that it doesn't produce a ton of ash. And so there's very little to deal with, you know.
That's amazing. I know Lana and I have talked about what to do with wood ash, because we both have wood stoves that we partially, at least, heat with. And so, Lana, what's the deal with the wood ashes?
Well, like Scott, our pizza oven does not produce that much, but we have a regular wood stove, too. I spread wood ashes on the garden beds. And I usually save that up and then do a lot of it in the spring after the snow melts. And it's spread pretty thin, and I like to especially put it on where I'm going to put potatoes. My dad always did that. He said it would help with the ashes help with a little bit of potash. I don't know if it does or not, but that's where I put it, and it doesn't hurt. It's putting a burnt organic thing back on the land. That's what I do with mine.
I also use mine as a sort of a I put it on the icy patches on the sidewalk.
That works.
It kind of makes mucky, but it you just don't want to track it into the house.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So I try not to put it on the porch, but out on the sidewalk.
Maybe I should do that at the restaurant and see.
Oh, it'll make
save some money on salt.
I don't know, but your new carpet would be.
Of course not.
Really be a mess. But do you burn yourself sometimes?
No, you know.
No more than a normal chef?
Right. And less than some chefs that I've seen. But,
no.
I mean, you know, I don't. I'd like to think that my kitchen is a fairly safe place to work. I mean, you are working with very hot stuff, but we have tools to address that. And so I take it kind of personally and professionally if people are getting injured, myself included, you know, it's so we try to avoid that as much as possible.
I have done some events in a kitchen at Esalen Institute, and on the kitchen door there's a sign that says, "Caution, we carry knives and play with fire."
Yeah, exactly. Well, and when you think about, you know, the job, you know, and what's involved, I mean, there's quite a few hazards.
Right. There's the speed that things are going. And this is true always in a kitchen. You are dealing with hot things, and
absolutely,
they're usually crowded and lots of motion, and there's certain it's like a dance choreography in a professional kitchen.
Yeah, if I had any station to choose from, I'd be a sauté guy, even though I like all the other parts of it too. But for me, and that's – I always hurt myself the most on a sauté station just because you have six –
A sauté station is where you're doing a sort of quick frying of ingredients to go onto other plates.
Right. So you've got six or eight burners, maybe more, maybe
fast,
less.
Hot.
It's extremely fast-paced. And, you know, for any particular dish, you may have three pans going for one plate. And so
– And it's really about timing and
absolutely
body movement. And it really – that's one thing I miss about kitchen work when I'm not doing it is there's an intimate choreography, and it is a lot like dancing.
Oh,
and
for
everyone
sure
in the kitchen is aware of each other's physicality, so you
absolutely
don't bump, burn, drop, smash.
Yeah.
And that's it's lovely.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, and I don't know how far off topic we're going, but, you know, when a chef expedites a line, I mean – you know, a lot of people will understand maybe an expediter as somebody who is just, you know, taking the food out to a table.
Tell
you know,
them what expediting is.
Expediting, at its most basic level, is the person that stands on the opposite side of the cook line that is taking the dishes as they're prepared and getting it to the table that it belongs to. And most operations nowadays, that is all that person does. But in a proper kitchen, in a true professional kitchen, the expediting is done by either a sous chef or the chef de cuisine or the executive chef, where
that's sort of higher up on the pecking order.
Yeah, their duties go far beyond just arranging the plates on the tray and getting it to the table. They are, like you say, the choreography. They are the ones that are directing the workflow of every single cook on the line.
Who does what when, so that it
exactly
all comes together at the right time, the right temperature,
right,
to go out to the table together.
Yeah. And there's and when kitchens are, and this is the way I like to try to run my kitchens, on at the busiest times, line cooks will not even have time to look up to look at a ticket. And so the chef or the sous chef is the person running, expediting the line should be the one that is letting those cooks know exactly what's next for them in line so they can plan ahead and know their next movement. And like you said, it's a choreography, it's a dance, and when it's done right, it's really awesome.
It's really nice to know that there's human beings doing things, putting their life on the line. But
yep,
still, good food.
Sure.
Good knowledge and wonderful technique. It's fun to watch. It's fun to watch a pizza being made at your
Well, it's true. Like at your restaurant, since it's all wall out front, you really do see, and it's sort of a mini model because the variables you've limited by having just pizza,
right,
which makes it really smooth. But in terms of really understanding what a restaurant kitchen is like, it's quite fascinating.
Sure.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good show.
It's a good show.
Well, thank you very much. Sure. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you for coming to talk with us today, and we learned a lot about cooking with fire. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. Want to ask you to let us know what you think of the Donna Lana Kitchen, your recipes, your ideas. What's on your plate? So contact us here at the studio, KHOI. You can visit our website, find out what's going on. That's KHOIFM.org. Or if you want to talk to me, send me an email with ideas or recipes or questions, whatever you've got, opinions. Send it to me at onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. And if you put Donna Lana Kitchen or DLK in the subject line, it will help me sort of sort out my life there. That would help a lot. So anyway, we are back. I'm going to ask Donna, what did you do this weekend?
Oh, I had a very special occasion this weekend. PFI had a field day where they premiered a new play written by the poet laureate of Iowa, Mary Swander. And the play is called Map of My Kingdom. And it's really about farmland transition. You know, when the grandparents die, how do they pass the farm on to the next generation? And how those sticky issues are dealt with. Because, and PFI commissioned this play for Mary Swander because, and I could have the statistics wrong, but something like a large percentage, anyway, of Iowa farmland will be transferred from one generation to the next over the next 15 to 20 years. And what happens, you know, a lot of times is not everybody wants to farm, and the kids are living in Kansas City or Chicago or San Francisco. And so we now in Iowa, we have a lot of out-of-state ownership of farmland. And one of the things that happens when farmland is rented out for cash rent, as they call it, the farmer who's doing the farming has the incentive to make the most amount of money off of the land rather than to conserve the soil qualities or build it. Or so, you know, we're getting some difficult farming issues from this because certainly there are many, many, many fine farmers that don't do this. But the tendency is to kind of basically mine the qualities of the land for soil value. Because it takes a lot of management and it produces less immediate cash if you're actually, you know, factoring in how to build soil and doing the, you know, cover cropping and rotations. And, you know, the tendency is to just do corn and beans and corn and beans, and that does deplete the soil eventually. So these are some major issues that are affecting, you know, the long-term soil capacities of our rich heritage in Iowa.
And to have this topic covered in a play, it's wonderful to have a play to deal with this.
But yeah, because death, who wants to talk about death and estate planning? You know, I mean, most farmers and most people just think, well, you know, they're going to take me out feet first and I'm not going to, I am just not dealing with this. And it's thorny family issues and stuff like this. So Mary Swander wrote a play. It's called Map of My Kingdom. It's a monologue. And she did it by constructing a female character who turns out to be a lawyer, and the primary purpose of her practice is to work with, you know, estate planning for families of farmers. And so she talks about different case histories and, you know, tells stories of the good, the bad, and the ugly that have happened. And it's humorous. And
this play will be available. Keep your ears open. We'll let you know when it'll be playing
right.
It'll
be playing all around Iowa a number of times. It's called Map of My Kingdom.
And you referred to PFI, that's Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Right.
And they've funded this play, and they have a lot of things going on. You also have something else to share with us. We've been promising and delivering dessert of the week.
Ah, okay. Well, we had a dinner before the play, which is why I was there. And it was at Scattergood, which is the Friends School over by Iowa City. And it's a farming school. So we had the meat from the school, the vegetables were from the garden, and the dessert was not from Scattergood. So what we had was ice cream with hot fudge sauce. So the dessert recipe, the cold summer dessert recipe of the week is hot fudge sauce. And I would encourage you to serve it with some of these peaches that we might be able to get. So nothing like vanilla ice cream, peaches, and or blueberries, and hot fudge sauce. So the hot fudge sauce, it's just one of those delicious, sensual things that you kind of don't think about it. But it's, again, it's the heat of the ice, of the hot fudge on the cold ice cream. So to make it is terribly simple. You just kind of construct a double boiler. I just put a pan, I put a metal cooking bowl over a pan of hot water. No big deal. You don't want the bowl to touch the water. Then I pour in a pack of dark chocolate chips, a usual package. I don't know, what are they, 16, 18 ounces? Maybe it's 14. Anyway, you know, the standard size. And I like to use dark, semi-sweet chocolate. Because, you know, your ice cream's going to be pretty sweet already. So I keep my fudge sauce a little darker. So you put the chocolate chips in, then you pour like a cup of cream over it, whole cream, and it's kind of melting together from the double boiler. A pinch of salt, and I put a little bit of vanilla extract, a jot of black pepper.
A jot.
Just a tiny, tiny bit, you know, to give it a little peak. And I put in and also a little bit of very finely ground canela cinnamon, not regular cinnamon. It gives it a kind of fruity flavor. And a tiny, tiny bit of cardamom. You don't want to have a really pronounced flavor, but it gives that kind of underground spice. But, you know, just plain mixing the cream and the dark chocolate with a little vanilla will do it as well. And then, you know, you've got it all heated up. And you spoon it over the ice cream with a little fruit.
Does this have to, like, come to a boil to
no.
mix it?
No. All you're doing really is melting the chocolate into the cream.
Oh.
And you'll see it just incorporates very smoothly. If it's too thick, you can add a little more milk or cream, you know, until you get the consistency that you want to kind of pour over the ice cream. And it's fail-proof, and I've never seen it not be a huge hit.
And heaven forbid that there would be any left over, but does this keep in the refrigerator?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you just put it in a jar and stick it in the fridge, and it'll keep a couple of weeks because of the cream.
Good, so you can have it on your cornflakes for the next morning.
You can, but, you know, it will get a little solid.
Solid.
If you want to reheat it, you could, you know, stick the jar probably in, like you would reheat honey or something, in some warm water or microwave or something, or... I have a terrible habit of just, like, sticking the spoon in the jar and snuckering it away.
Well, it's a good treat. Mm-hmm. A spoon of hot fudge.
Yeah, it's like, but once it gets cold, it's like eating a chocolate truffle out of the refrigerator.
Oh, what a good idea. So, yeah. Dessert of the week.
Decadent.
Hot fudge sundaes on some really good ice cream and use some seasonal fruit. That'd be really nice. I would think. I've got another thing I wanted to mention today. We talked about cooking things really hot in hot ovens, and we got Hot Fudge Sunday going on. I'm going to talk about another sort of hot thing, and I'm going to talk about mustard. Mustard I grow a lot of in my garden. I have lots of different kinds. And I brought some today so you could taste.
Got green and red.
There's green and red.
And one of them is, it's kind of ruffly and fluffy and it's beautiful.
Right. Mustards are a wonderful thing to grow, and they take a little heat in the midsummer when some of your other salads seem to go away.
Oh, right, and they don't get bitter when the lettuce
starting to bolt.
Yeah.
They taste like mustard. Mm-hmm. I can recommend, for those of you who might like a mild sort of mustard, there's a little pointy-leafed one called Mizuna. That's a very
And you have to know it's a mustard green as opposed
mustard
to a
green.
Mustard seed.
Yeah.
Or
this is before it goes. I suppose if I let it go to seed, I could grind these seeds and make mustard. But this is the green stuff, little green leaves with pointy edges. Mizuna.
So Mizuna is a mustard. I didn't
Mizuna
realize
Mizuna is a mustard.
So, it's not very spicy at all.
It's not very spicy at all. Then I have another variety, and I'm sure there's different names for this. There's a India or smooth leaf mustard. Again, that's a rather mild
mustard.
And
that's kind of what people classically refer to as mustard greens,
mustard
right?
Mustard greens. It cooks down. Then there's some really nice
And it's slightly fuzzy on the leaf. Slightly.
Yeah, that's this one. And as you get your way up in different varieties, there are hotter ones.
So wait, what's this one that's fuzzy?
I've got
fuzzy?
One called a Southern Giant Green Curled. Those words, Southern Giant, Greeny, Curled, that's going to give you a kick. That's a bit more sharp mustard, more hotter mustard.
And those are the ones that are sort of classically quick sautéed and stewed down into your classic mustard greens.
Mustard greens. And put a little with your collard greens or kale.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit. You don't have to eat all mustard. Then I have one more variety.
Oh, and this is a beauty.
Donna really likes this kind. It's kind of new on the market, at least new for me the past couple of years. I've seen them in seed catalogs. There's something called frills. And it's a real jaggedy edge, frilly looking thing.
Yeah, it's almost like a frisée in a lettuce. So it's fluffy. It's a kind of a deep reddish green, so it's very pretty in salads.
Yes. And that one is called Scarlet Frills. It also comes out in a gold frill. There's also a green frill. And that has a wonderful, nice kick to it. So that's keep those things in mind if you want to taste some hot.
And you know what? Chopped mustard greens, like especially the frills kind, are very nice in a potato salad, certainly a green salad, or cooked down, like you said, in any kind of stir fry.
Mm-hmm.
So the wonderful thing about mustard is it's both cookable, or you can eat it raw. Or stick it in sandwiches, even. That's it. You know, where you might put lettuce, you stick a little mustard, and that's just
a wonderful
nifty
thing.
Little surprise. You don't see it coming.
So tantalize your taste buds. Heat up your mouth with a little bit of mustard every now and then. Yes. There's also arugula in that family, too. So enjoy these midsummer greens.
Together or interchangeably.
All sorts of. Just eat yourself away there with some nice spicy foods. I have another thing I'd like to share is kind of my herb of the week. And that is something called wood sorrel. You may have it in your garden because, again, it's one of those things that show up and you think, well, it's a weed.
Wow, I didn't know what this is.
And it is listed under noxious weeds, wood sorrel, or it's also called oxalis. Oxalis is the Latin name, O-X-A-L-I-S,
oxalis. It's very clover-like looking in the leaf form, isn't it?
It looks like a mini, very delicate clover or a mini, very delicate shamrock, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a three-leafed clover-leaf thing.
Yeah, and they're kind of heart-shaped, very pretty.
Yes, it puts up a little, when the sun is out, it puts up a tiny, tiny yellow flower. There are two varieties that grow rampantly around here. You can find it in either red or the dark red or green.
I'm chomping on it as we speak. And
it is
sorrel-like. It's very lemony.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love it.
Yes.
Another more salad material here.
So you can weed it out of your garden if you want to, but do stop and as they say, stop and smell the roses. Stop and taste the weeds. This is a wonderful thing to taste.
Is this what the kids call sour flower, do you think?
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah.
Well, it makes a little yellow flower, maybe.
I know it's called wood sorrel, and it tastes like sorrel.
It's not really in the sorrel
family, though. No.
Wood sorrel.
No. Anyway.
Makes a nice little posy bunch.
I have a little bit on wood sorrel from a book called The Wild Food Cookbook by Frances Hammerstrom, and this is probably out of print.
Oh, but it's adorable.
It's a great book.
It's from ISU, right?
Iowa State University Press. First edition was published in 1989, and I looked on the website. It is still available in back orders and in old books and
from the
like
library.
That. You can get it from Iowa State University.
Oh,
Press,
you can
I
still
think.
Buy
yeah.
it from.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, I might so have to get a copy of that.
Yeah, it's just really fun. There's a lot of things I can share with
you. Yeah, it's really local stuff. It's excellent.
Right. Here's what she's got to say about wood sorrel. This delicate little herb is to be found in sunny situations, particularly where the soil has been recently disturbed throughout the late spring and summer. The flavor is tart, acid, and refreshing. The sprigs of wood sorrel are exquisite as a garnish for fish. Small quantities
Yes.
taste very good in any sort of salad. This plant should not be eaten in huge quantities because it contains oxalic acid. But I can't imagine eating huge quantities of this.
It'd be a little tedious.
But it's got a lovely little taste. A sprig bearing 8 or 10 leaves and a few flowers per portion is sufficient for an attractive garnish. Yes, it is. And so there it is in your garden, probably just waiting for you. So that is wood sorrel. That is also, flipping around, right next to wood sorrel in this book is something that we probably all want to know about, how to cook a woodchuck.
How much wood would a woodchuck cut if it could chuck wood all day?
At least like that. So you might think wood sorrel is a weed in your garden. Woodchucks tend to visit gardens and be rather pesty. A couple years ago, I had a whole family that really did in a couple rows in my garden. And they're wonderful to watch, and the little ones are cuter than the dickens. But boy, oh boy, can they cause havoc. And what Frances Hammerstrom in the Wild Food Cookbook has to say about woodchucks. The woodchuck, marmot, or groundhog, sometimes is even called the whistle pig. It is really a squirrel. It climbs trees badly, swims badly, and is usually not very far from its hole, into which it pops quickly. After a good fright, it's not very apt to come out again for 10 or 15 minutes. At first, it will only show its head a few times. Unfortunately, woodchucks are often lost by inexperienced hunters who cannot resist squeezing the trigger too soon. One should wait until it is well above ground and properly out of its hole. Not infrequently, woodchucks cause enough crop damage so that farmers class them as varmints. To prepare a woodchuck, dress it out immediately. Skinning may be put off for a few hours if needed. Look for and remove the glands beneath the armpits. You do that for squirrels, too. These may give the meat a strong taste. For woodchuck stew, 1 big woodchuck, 5 sprigs mint, 1 large onion, 1/2 teaspoon ground cloves, a bouillon cube, salt and pepper. Put this all in a pot. Cover with water. Boil until the water is almost gone and the bones are easily removed from the meat, and then you serve it
a long, strong simmer.
Yes, a long, strong simmer. And then serve on toast. So there. If you happen to run across a woodchuck, wave this recipe underneath his little nose. He may leave your garden alone.
Valuable information from the Donna Lana Kitchen Show.
Yes. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Today we talked about cooking with fire with special guest Scott Cold Iron from Vesuvius Pizza. We learned a lot about hot things. He also talked about
maybe he'd let us cook some woodchucks in his oven one night.
Oh, we could do that. That'd be good. We talked a little bit about mustard. We talked a little bit about wood sorrel, and about the play Map of My Kingdom. Let us know what you think of the Donna Lana Kitchen, recipes, ideas. You can contact me at onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. Visit the KHOI website at khoifm.org and support your local community radio station. You heard music by Keith Arneson on the banjo and the band Providence. I'm Lana Noctic.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food. Enjoy life.